Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is composer Richard Gibbs for part two of our conversation, but this time it's all about his excellent studio, Woodshed Recording. But first, let's talk about MQA. There was some news this week that Universal Music signed a deal with MQA, and now they join the other two major labels as being on the MQA team. What is MQA? It stands for Master Quality Authenticated. And it's a process to make everything sound better, essentially. It's not a file format. Hopefully this will be something that will be used for all high-res streaming in the future. Now there's a lot of people behind it. There's all three major record labels. There's the RIAA, and there's Naris, the Grammy people, among others, that are all pushing for this. So far, there's only one company, one streaming company that's using it, and that's Tidal. Now, what's interesting about this is it kind of rides along with a lossless codec like FLAC or ALAC. ALAC is Apple Lossless Audio Codec. That's their version of FLAC. What it will do is we'll take a 96K file or a 192K file, whatever it is, and it will fold all of the frequencies that we can't hear, like 90K, fold that into the noise floor, and basically anything above our hearing range. It gets folded into the noise floor when it gets encoded, and then when it gets decoded, it comes all back out the way it went in. And what you end up with is something that supposedly sounds better, has less blurring, has less digital artifacts, and it's coming at everything from a different perspective, a different approach, which is all well and good, but the big thing is you need a hardware or software encoder decoder to make it work, just like Dolby. So remember, on cassettes, for instance, every player had a Dolby selection. The same thing would happen here. If you're listening on a player of any type, it would have to have a MQA selection on it in order for you to hear it. And then if there was something that was encoded with MQA, there would be a little light that would light up, and that would be the authentication to tell you that in fact it is MQA encoded. Well, I think the real question here is this going to catch on? Because Meridian Audio, who came up with MQA, they actually want to charge everybody for it, which they should, it's their technology. But as a result, just like Dolby, all the hardware manufacturers are going to have to pay a royalty. They're going to have to include it in their hardware, in their D to A converters, for instance. And this doesn't matter if it's on a phone or if it's in a high-quality audio file system. It doesn't matter. And also, anybody that's streaming it is also going to have to pay a royalty. And the royalty may reach all the way back to the artist paying to encode it. Now, I wonder how many artists are going to say, well, wait a second, my stuff is smashed the way it is. I don't think we're really doing anything that's audiophile. Why would anybody care? Because they haven't cared so far. MP3 is just fine. And record labels will say that as well, many of them. So I wonder if this is going to catch on or not. Certainly, I think high-res audio is the future, and high-res streaming is the future. We're going to see that sooner or later, and we're going to see it in a big way from Apple, and they're actually going to push everybody else into it. That being said, I'm not so sure that MQA is going to be part of that, because it'll be another one of those things where instead of being more convenient, it's going to be something about quality. And as we've seen throughout the years in the music business, people don't buy quality. They buy convenience. Will high-res audio be convenient? No. But what will happen is it will eventually be just part of the audio that we receive. It's going to be a feature, and it's going to be one that you're going to see each streaming network claim. You'll pay the same amount of money. At first, it may be you'll pay a little bit more for a higher tier, and then eventually that's just the streaming audio that you'll receive. This may not be next year, it may not be the year after, but sooner or later, that's going to be the case. So I just wanted to comment on this because there was a news item earlier in the week about Universal Music signing on to MQA. And if any of you have seen it, I wanted to just give you some backstory on why this happened and maybe what the future holds. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. Now let's talk about hearing loss. We all have it. As we get older, it happens more and more, first on the high frequencies and then on all the frequencies. And especially happens to musicians a lot, or people that work with music. Musicians, if you're playing a lot on stage, there's feedback that will take your hearing out. That happens a lot. There are things like cymbal crashes that might do it. And certainly that's one of the problems for me. It was being on the side where this crash cymbal was always there, and that hurt my hearing in that ear. But regardless, it would be great if there was some way that we could get that hearing back. And there's actually been some research into that that may be a big breakthrough. This was done by the researchers at MIT and Harvard. One of the problems is we have these kind of like hair-like cells in our ears, and they can die when they're exposed to too much SPL. There's two sets of them, actually, in each ear. One is just for frequency, and the other responds just to level. Then that transmits into electrical energy in our brain. When these die, they're gone forever. We're not getting them back, and that's why we have permanent hearing loss. There are some animals, in fact, that can regenerate these. And there's only one mammal that can do it, and it's actually a baby mouse, and that's what they use, the stem cells from a baby mouse, in order to grow these hair-like sensitivity cells. And they were successful in doing it. Happy day. Well, the problem is, because all this is in your inner ear, you're not going to get a transplant anytime soon, because it's just not easy. But what they're doing is they're using these regrown cells to experiment on with new drugs, with new techniques to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and actually regenerating your own hearing cells without having to implant new ones. Whatever the case, this looks like a really good step along the way of helping us all to stop from losing our hearing. Now, again, this isn't something that's going to occur next week or maybe even next year, but it's a step in the right direction. In the meantime, protect your hearing. And there are two ways to do that that I use all the time. One is by a company called Earpiece, and it's about $20. You get three earpieces, and they're basically ear protectors that stick in your ears. You get an extra one in case you lose one. The other one is the old standby by Etymotic Research, the ETY-20s. These have been around forever, and they're about $13 or $14, and I've used them forever and ever, and they work great. One of the good things about both of these companies, and there's lots of others that do this as well, but when you get real ones that are made specifically for attenuating audio, that's all they do. They don't change your frequency response. Where if you put tissues in your ear or those sponge hearing protectors, things like that, they not only lower the audio level, but they also really wreck the frequency response. So the beauty about Earpiece and Etymotic Research is the fact that they'll lower the level and they'll pretty much keep the frequency response intact, which is exactly what you want. So there's good news on the hearing loss front, but in the meantime, do whatever you can to protect your hearing. Richard Gibbs is a film composer who has scored more than 60 movies, as well as television shows like Battlestar Galactica and The Simpsons. His studio, which is Woodshed Recording, is truly a one-of-a-kind place. Major artists also think so as well, as the likes of U2, Coldplay, Lady Gaga, Barbara Streisand, Muse, Kanye West, Metallica, and Sting, and many, many others can regularly be found using the facility. In part two of my interview with Richard, we speak about why Woodshed is so unique and how he came to build it. I've been to your studio, I've written about it, and I think it's one of the world's great studios, just in terms of concept and location and lots of things that make it unique. And obviously there's major artists that feel the same way because you're busy with super high quality artists all the time. So that being said, how did the studio come about?
Well, the studio was built for me. I built it for my own usage as a film composer and sometime television composer and sometime record producer. So I didn't, the happy accident of this is that it turns out that there are plenty of other people who like the same thing that I do. that if I was building the studio back when I started building it, if I had built it to rent it out, there's no way I would have done what I did. And so I took a lot of chances in studio design because I figured I'm the only one that's going to be in it anyway. But, well, turns out that a lot of other people feel the same way I do about how studio design should be approached.
Yeah, definitely. It's unique. I mean, first of all, it's beautiful and the location is fantastic. So there's that, but it's very airy. It's very open. You can open up the windows, beautiful breeze, sea breeze coming through, and there's light all over the place. And that's the wonderful part about it, but it's contrary to what most studios are like.
Well, because most studios are designed by engineers, or at least for engineers and acousticians, and the people that are building the studios are following the edicts of acousticians and engineers. But, and I'm not meaning to discount those edicts. They exist for a reason, but sometimes rules are meant to be broken. And I definitely approach this from, I move that way down the priority list. My priority was, again, building it for me. I wanted a place that just felt good, that was really fun to work in, and really took advantage of the outside environment and brought that in as much as possible. And that, of course, is anathema to acoustic design. That meant I was going to have a lot of glass everywhere. But you're referring to the location. We're overlooking the ocean. There was no way I was going to block that view. So that meant a lot of glass. And glass has inherently in it two problems acoustically. One is that it's highly reflective, and it's not a pleasant reflection because it's a brittle sound. And two, it is also it also tends to leak sound. The sound can get out through glass unless you really layer it heavily. So those were problems, and we just had to figure out how to compensate for it because, again, there was no way we were going to block our view. And we did. We figured out how to make it work.
Did you have special windows made?
Every door, every window in the studio was custom built for the studio. It doesn't look like it. They look like normal doors and windows. That was another thing that was kind of my own edict in the studio design was, whenever possible, I wanted to hide the fact that it was a recording studio. I didn't want you to feel like you were in a recording studio. This is in my backyard, and the last thing in the world, if I was a doctor, the last thing I would build in my backyard is an operating room. So I felt like the last thing in the world I wanted to do was build a recording studio in my backyard that felt like a recording studio. I wanted it to feel more like a house. And it does, as you know. It feels more like you're in a house overlooking the ocean, and it's just really comfortable. But it does have all of the functionality and more of a standard recording studio, but it's hidden. And sometimes hidden meaning out of sight, other times meaning hidden in terms of there's functionality within the walls and within the floor and other aspects of it that you don't realize are there. But they're the placement of a wall in a certain way, or the way the furniture even is, or where the shelves are on the wall. You know, we have shelves on the wall that in one corner where I stacked up all my percussion instruments, and it's kind of the relatively messy corner of the studio, but that was by design, because we knew if we put all that percussion, all that stuff there, that it would diffract the sound and break up that sound of a 90-degree angle, which is a problem in acoustic design. You don't want to have that. So it's there, but it's hidden behind all drums and gamelans and other instruments and stuff, so it breaks that sound up. That's one example of probably that I could give you.
You also had a problem with the fact that your studio, or prior to being your studio, it was a historical site, right?
No, I think what you might be thinking, you might be conflating. No, we have problems in that we're in the city of Malibu, and we're near the ocean, and we had to deal with the Coastal Commission And we're also in an area that's called, it's called ESHA, Environmentally Sensitive Habitat Area, ESHA. So there were certain things we had to pay attention to with the Coastal Commission. But the historical part of it, you might be thinking, is that Chris Martin has said a couple times to me that he thinks that the studio now should be registered with the U.S. historical landmarks. That's how he feels about it.
Well, I agree with him, but didn't you tell me that you were restricted from doing any major construction in terms of making it larger or anything?
Yes. Not because of historical reasons. That's what I'm saying. It was the conflation there. That was because of the building codes in Malibu. We couldn't go any larger than the footprint. There was a guest house where the studio is now with the exact same footprint. I couldn't go any larger than that footprint. So we tore it down and started from scratch, but we couldn't expand beyond that because of the building codes in Malibu.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought that you worked within the existing structure, that it was a barn or something, and you had worked within what was there in terms of...
Okay. Well, I was trying to keep your listeners from hearing all the gory details, but actually, yeah, it had originally been a horse stable. And then before we bought the house, before we bought this property, somebody else had converted it to a guest house. So it was this really kind of shoddily constructed guest house. And when we bought it, the first thing I did was to gut it and use it as a temporary studio until I could figure out what I wanted to build. And then we tore it down, and I rented another guest house not too far away to use as my temporary studio while we built this studio from scratch. Technically, it was supposed to be a remodel, but they call it a California remodel, where you rip down everything except one wall and you can get in under remodel rules. But in our case, we ended up very quickly even destroying what little was left. There's not one molecule left from the original structure.
Okay, I didn't realize that. So how long did it take you to build?
Well, it was 2 years of plans and permits, because we had to go through Coastal Commission and the City of Malibu, and it was a lot of it. It took a while because I really wanted to wrap my head around, because we were building something that was so different, not just for a guest house, but for a studio. There was no template that we could go off of at all because of the many different things we wanted to do in this structure. So that took a bit longer because of that, and then add on top of that all the red tape and all the paperwork and all the hoops we had to jump through with the city and the California Coastal Commission. That was 2 years just for that process, then another 2 years of construction.
Wow.
So 4 years total.
Wow.
With a little bit of overlap in the middle of that.
Wow.
I mean, like the first 2 years, like when we were going through plans and permits, the building was still there. I was still using it while we were going through plans and permits. And then at one point we finally got, okay, we've got permits, and we tore down the structure. There was a funny story with that, where we had the structure was being torn down. I was down at the city that morning getting a sign off on something else. And suddenly somebody realized there was a problem with the paperwork. And they said, no, you can't do this now. You're going to have to wait another year or 6 months to start. I was horrified, and I called my contractor immediately, like from a cell phone, and I said, hey, how's it going, Kevin? He goes, and he just started laughing. He goes, well, if you want me to stop, it's too late. And I go, no, that's exactly why I was calling. It was too late. It was gone. It had literally been wiped off my property with a bulldozer. So we got through that little red tape snafu, bureaucratic mess. And it was all fine. But yeah, it was almost 4 years from start to finish.
How much did it change from beginning to end?
Well, quite a bit. We started with one architect and ended up changing horses in the middle of the stream there. So that changed quite a bit. Originally, the interior design called for a, it was going to be more of a standard studio with, you know, hard walls and inside and, you know, pass doors and kind of what you normally see in a studio, but with some windows looking out over the ocean. And it's kind of a long story, but basically we found out that we could do more inside that, you know, that footprint than we'd originally thought as far as the city was concerned. We thought we had to leave certain interior walls, at least one interior wall, because that's originally what we were told. And as it turned out, we didn't have to do that. I ended up talking to one guy at the city. He goes, I don't care what you do with the inside walls as long as you keep the outside the same footprint. You can do whatever you want inside. And that's when a light bulb went off for me. I said, okay, I can destroy all interior walls. And that's exactly what we did. And the interior walls now, as you know, all move. Everything, that's one of the most unique things about this studio is that everything morphs depending on what you're doing. All the equipment moves, including the main speakers. Everything can slide in different places in different locations inside the studio, and all the interior walls move, so you can set up, you can have it as one giant open room. You can have a small control room. You can have a large control room. You can have different control rooms. There are many different configurations, and once I realized we could do that, that's when we kind of put a halt to the whole process. And I brought in a different architect, and we rethought the whole studio. So it was that was quite a radical shift at that point. Then from then on, it stayed what it was.
Okay, so there's three unique things that come to mind immediately for me about the studio. And the one is the movable walls. The first one, anyways, the movable walls. I'm curious, though, the fact that everything can move in the studio. If you were intending this to be just for you, wouldn't there be just one setup that you liked, that you preferred?
If I only did one thing, that would be true. In other words, if I only produced five-piece rock bands for a living, that would be true. Or if I only wrote orchestral scores, that would be true. But the fact of the matter is I do all these different things. I sometimes score movies that, you know, I wrote the theme for Battlestar Galactica, and that was all Japanese taiko drums. And that took up a lot of space. I needed high ceilings and something for that. Other times I'm working here and I'm recording, you know, Vinnie Colaiuta playing drums, overdubbing on an artist that I'm producing, and that's a different sound. I need a different room sound. So the walls are set up differently. Vinnie locates in a different place than the taiko drummer is located. So I'm always, even just myself, forget about other artists coming in, I always use the room in different ways. And I knew that much I knew because of the nature of what I do. I'm always changing up the sound. I think most composers do. I'm always changing up the sound of what I do, and the room very much affects that. So having a flexible room allowed me to really do different. I can record any ensemble, up to 30 players in any number of configurations. Yeah. I've had a 50-kid choir in there even. So.
Wow. Yeah, I was just going to ask you how many players you can put in. What I find interesting is the fact that once you did that for yourself, you didn't have to go into town anymore, I guess, right? Unless you're going to do a really big orchestra date. But
no. Well, yeah. And I quite often do write for a large orchestra.
Yeah.
So I still go into town. I'll still, you know, the last orchestral project I did, we did it on the Fox scoring stage because there was no way that orchestra would fit in my room. And I can fit 30 players, but that depends on what they're playing. You know? I could fit 50 guys playing flutes, but when I say 30 players, that was a string orchestra, so that had basses and cellos and, you know, bigger instruments. I don't know how many trombone players I could fit in there, but probably not that many because of the slides.
Yeah, right.
So it depends on the instrument.
Yeah. Okay, so the second unique thing to me is the fact that you can move the speakers, the console controller, the outboard gear, you can move that anywhere in the room. Did people look at you like you were crazy when you brought that up?
Well, Fortunately, no, because I didn't hire people that had done this before. That was kind of the fun thing about the whole project. My architect had never even set foot in a recording studio before. So the beauty of that was he didn't have any preconceived notions of what a studio should look like. We toured. He and I became great friends during this process. As a gentleman named Kai Yang. He's the guy who was the ultimate architect on this project. We went to all of my favorite studios in terms of design. I made appointments with the studio managers. Said, "Could we go in and take a look at this?" And they were all very open to it. I told them why we were looking. And after we looked at all these different studios, we would pretty much became a joke between us. We would look at each other and say, "Okay, he's Chinese, so I'm going to imitate him. Okay, now we know what not to do." So it was a lot of that. He's looking at these recording studios from a design point of view, and most of them are horrific in terms of aesthetic design. They're just horrible.
Yeah.
And even for human design, even in terms of what makes people comfortable. Again, they're always designed for acoustics and for engineering, and that's not humans or music. Two different things.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that after a while, it becomes an accepted standard. Whether it's good or bad doesn't matter. It's the standard. So you've seen one successful studio one way, and you figure, okay, that's the way it has to be, and then it kind of morphs. Well, it doesn't morph. It replicates after that. And I think that's what happened, and there hasn't been too much thinking outside the box. I mean, actually, in the last 10 years, there has been. There's more light in studios in general, and there's more people that have similar setups to you, but certainly more leaning more traditional than the way you did. That's for sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've noticed that too. There's been more flexibility in studio design, but you're also right. There was a certain there's certain studio design aesthetics and practicalities that have been accepted as that's how it's done. It really became clear to me when I first started talking to people about this whole process before I brought in architects at all. I was talking to studio designers, and they would come, and I don't want to name the companies, but very highly respected studio designers and companies would come. They'd look at the property, they'd see the size of it, and they'd say, "Okay, we think this will work." And they were literally pulling out templates that they had in their portfolios. We can say, "Yeah, we just tweak this a little bit, and that'll work there." And I wasn't really liking their line of thinking. They were just trying to retrofit what was a standard design. Great studios they designed. Nothing against them, but it wasn't what I wanted. And this one guy came in, and we were just kind of trying to figure out how to make the studio work temporarily. The existing thing there, and how to run cable runs, where should I set this up, and that. And he just said, "Well, why don't you just set up there? Don't determine your cable run yet. Just set up over there and see if you like it. And then if you don't like it, then move it over there, and we can always punch a window in the wall over there." So his thinking was find out where I'm comfortable first. The best analogy for this for me was I read about this this complex outside of Milan where the architect, it was this big multi-use complex with condominiums, apartments, and stores and businesses, and I don't know how many acres, but a huge complex, right?
Mm-hmm.
It had all this mixed use, and the architect had designed all the buildings and come up with really great designs for the interiors of the apartments and the stores and so on. And toward the end of the project, the landscape architect is brought in, and he goes to meet with the chief architect for the project and said, "Okay, we're going to start figuring out where to put bushes and so on. Can you show me, I don't see here anywhere, where the sidewalks go?" And the architect said, oh, no, that's by design. And the landscape architect says, well, how do I know where to put the, you know, the bushes and the plants and the trees and the flowers? And he said, well, just plant grass for now. The people will tell us where the sidewalks need to go.
Hmm.
And I loved that, you know, that concept of let the design of the people, where they're going to walk, where they're going to hit on. Now we see they're wearing a brown path in the grass from here to there. That's where we need to put a sidewalk. And that's the width of the sidewalk and the strength of it because of how heavy the traffic is to it. So this kind of was a design precept that was in my mind the whole time when we're building this studio, is to try to keep things open as much as possible to the possibilities of what could happen in the future. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. Oh, absolutely. And you can see that brought out in Woodshed because it's function follows form. Is that the quote? Form follows function. Whatever the case, it just feels that way, where you did everything in such a way where it's comfortable for the user rather than the architect or the engineer.
I think the phrase is normally form follows function. And that would be an argument for the standard studio design, because standard studio design is designed for the function. It's the question of which function.
Right, right.
That's where we stood that on its ear, is that for me, the function of a recording studio, it's a place to create music. For an engineer, it's a place to record music. And it's a big difference there right away if you really, you know, kind of bear down on that. And this is a creative facility, first and foremost, not an engineering facility. The engineering is in there, but it's done. It's a secondary consideration to the creative consideration, whereas normally it's the other way around.
One of the very coolest features of the studio, to me anyway, is one that's hidden, and that's your two ISO rooms underneath the studio, one for a Leslie and one for a guitar speaker cabinet. That's brilliant. Was that in the original design?
Not in the very original design, no. But it was something that had come into my mind early on when we were in this design process. I was working on a movie called Queen of the Damned with Jonathan Davis from Korn. And Jonathan had a studio at this big house he was renting in the Valley. And he had... you know, retro, I don't know what they'd done, retrofit a garage, I think it was, a big garage. And the standard kind of set up, kind of a crammed control room in a big open room. But out in the middle of the room, he had this box that was like, I don't know, say a 6-foot cube that was layer upon layer of drywall and cement and whatever, just in the middle of the room. And I said, Jonathan, what's that? And he goes, oh, that's my amp room. And that's where they would, you know, put their Marshall stack in there to work at blistering volume, and you couldn't hear the amplifier outside of that room. That's just where they. And I said, well, that's a brilliant idea. However, quite a waste of floor space,
yeah,
just to have a place to put a cabinet. So I just took that and said, well, why don't we just put it underneath the deck? Nobody's going to be in there anyway. And, you know, have these ISO booths that are just for the speaker cabinets. And either one of them, you know, one has, as you said, one has a Leslie, the other one has a Bogner speaker cabinet in it. But you could put anything in there you wanted to. That's just what I have in there.
That's brilliant.
And then the advantage of that is I can be playing my Hammond at, you know, blistering volume, but it's down below a cement deck with tile on it, and it's half subterranean. You can't hear that Hammond at all anywhere in the studio until you open up the microphones that are on the Leslie. So that means I can be sitting there, and somebody could be literally sitting on the bench next to me playing an acoustic guitar, and we have complete isolation between the two, and we hear each other through the headphones that way. It works great. And it's also another kind of unanticipated advantage of it is that most times guitarists have a problem. I'm sure you've had this experience where you're recording a guitar and he's got his amp set up out in the studio and he's tweaking the amp sound. He's got headphones on, so he can hear what's going on in the control room, and he's tweaking the sound of his amp. And you're in the control room, and you're tweaking the sound of how the microphones are capturing that amplifier, and you're getting happy with it. He's hearing it through his headphones. He thinks, yeah, that sounds good. And then he comes in the control room, and he'll say, that's not what I was hearing out there. Well, the reason is because he's in the room, he's adjusting the amplifier, not considering the fact that there's a considerable amount of bleed just coming through his speakers in the room, coming through his body, coming, you know, bleeding through the headphones acoustically. And so he adjusts the amp to get the sound that he wants, but that's not what the sound is.
Yeah.
With this setup, because the speaker is completely away from the guitarist, he sits there and tweaks his amp head using headphones or using the speakers that are in the studio, in the control room speakers, and that's exactly what's being recorded.
That's very cool.
So he's always they're always happy right away. And he can, again, just like the organ example, he can be at blistering volume and be in the room with the piano player or with the drummer in complete isolation, yet they're 2 feet away from each other and they can communicate and do what they need to do to make music together.
I want to go back to the walls for a second because they are so unique. When you say to someone movable walls, they have one thought and they think more like big gobos or something. And these are different because they actually do an airlock into the ceiling and the floor, but it's not one wall, it's two walls. So there's that natural airspace in between like you'd have on, you know, in most studios, which is brilliant. Brilliant when I think about it. It's like, wow, why didn't other people think of that? But the walls, though, you imported them. They weren't something built here, right?
Well, let me give credit where credit is due, first off. There's no one thing in this studio that I came up with on my own. There's nothing that I came up with on my own. It was more of an overall concept that's mine. For instance, those walls, the idea for that came from Capitol. The Capitol Studios down in the basement of the Capitol building in Hollywood. I know you've been down there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Between Studio A and Studio B, a lot of people don't realize, I worked there for years not knowing this. The common wall between Studio A and Studio B, the live rooms, collapses.
Yeah.
And that, when I saw that, I was scoring a movie and the studio manager, Paula Salvatore, called me up and said, hey, we can accommodate your orchestra here. And I said, no, you can't. I've got a 65-piece orchestra that won't fit in Studio A. And she said, yeah, we can. You didn't know. We can pull that wall down and we punch in the Studio B and we can fit your orchestra. And all the normal scoring stages in town were booked out during that time period. So we gave it a crack and it worked great. And that, you know, I salted that away in my memory bank system. Somehow I know I'm going to come back to that design. So when we came up with this idea of, we can put anything we want within that footprint, let's come up with a design for a wall system that we can create different spaces within this overall footprint. And I called up Paula and asked for the company that had built the walls for Capitol. So they were custom built, not quite overseas, close enough, Orange County.
Oh.
That's where they were built. And they came out and measured and, you know, put the walls in. It actually ended up, the interesting thing about that for me was that the original design, as I'd said, called for more of a standard control room, live room, vocal booth, machine room kind of setup. And when we priced that out, so I wanted everything done with certain materials, done a certain way. We wanted nice, heavy, you know, wood doors with glass in them so people could see, and nice sliders and it would seal off and all that. By the time we budgeted all that out, it was quite expensive. This movable wall system ended up being cheaper than a hard wall system would have been.
Wow.
And gave us so much more flexibility.
I thought those walls came from Germany for some reason.
Oh, I know. You're thinking of the doors. All the doors, there's sliding doors that go to the outside. And those were designed and those were made in Germany. for us. It was because the hardware that sealed against the wall and the ceiling and the door jams, that was a German design that really worked really well. It'd take a big slider and turn it basically into this locking mechanism. You pull down and it turns it into a wall. It seals completely all the way around. That was German. But that's not the interior walls that moved. Those were Orange County.
Got it. Okay, I understand now. Okay, speaking of materials, didn't you import some of the wood as well?
Well, I didn't personally, but we bought them from places that were importing the wood. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no such thing as domestic mahogany. So, all the doors and windows are made of mahogany that I think ultimately came from the Philippines. I'm not sure. And the floor is made of a material called Santos mahogany, which was it's not a true mahogany. It just kind of looks like a mahogany. And that was South American.
Hmm.
And then the superstructure up above, all the main beams and all that, and the roof is all Douglas fir, which is, of course, American.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's clear Douglas fir, which turned into, at every stage, I would say, hey, I want to put, wood. Well, then there's different types of woods, and we'd get into, what are the acoustic advantages of the wood? What's the look of this particular wood? Everything was, every single nut and bolt, piece of glass, piece of wood, cement, everything in this studio was considered three or four times over by a bunch of us. We all really kind of thought everything through, even the insulation in the walls. It's like, well, we wanted to be environmentally conscious, so didn't want to have even the chance of any little fiberglass fibers getting into our lungs. So it's all recycled, blue jeans.
Oh, right.
That kind of material, which isn't uncommon these days. But I'm just pointing out, we whenever there was a choice to be made in terms of material, almost without exception, I'm trying to think of an exception, I can't think of one, we'd end up going for the most expensive choice. We'd say, okay, well, let's do Douglas fir, and then my contractor will come back and say, great, Douglas fir will be great. Do you want clear Douglas fir or regular Douglas fir? And I didn't know the difference. And he showed me the difference. I go, oh, yeah, I like to look at clear Douglas fir. Bam, the cost went up 30% on that right away. because to select out that lumber that doesn't have the knots in it, it's much more expensive. But the knots would have made it look like it would have given it a more of a log cabin feel, and I didn't want that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So we started out with a budget of $250,000, and they always say, when you're going into construction, you always say that, the old line is figure out whatever your budget is and then double it, and in your mind that's what it'll end up being. I didn't double it. I quadrupled it. It came close. By the time we finished this, we spent close to $1 million on this studio. As my contractor put it, he ended up building the world's largest piece of furniture. Because that's the attention to detail and the fit and the fitment and everything about it is done like you're building a fine chair.
Well, yeah, it does come across that way. Definitely, definitely. Okay, so in this journey of yours, what advice would you have to somebody that's building a studio and wants to do something similar?
Oh, I would say tell them to talk to two people, and not necessarily in this order, their accountant and their shrink, because they'll both talk them out of it. I wouldn't recommend it. I really wouldn't to anybody unless they just, I happen to have more money than sense at that point in my career and life, and completely overbuilt. If I was building this from a business standpoint, it's a ridiculous amount of money to spend on a recording studio. It's insane. However, that turned out to be a great thing because there are all these people that really appreciate the architecture, really appreciate the vibe of the place and the feel of it, and they've become our most loyal clients, people like Barbra Streisand and Chris Martin and so on, because they love the feel that they have in that room, and that the feel comes from the architecture, the love of design, the high-end materials that we put into it, and we cut no corners anywhere. But I wouldn't recommend to somebody else that they do that at all. There's a very small market of elite artists. There's not that many these days, you know?
Yeah.
So we've captured a nice little client base, and we're really happy about that. We love all of our clients. But again, I didn't build this with that in mind. I built it for me, and I still use it. So it's kind of subsidized as a recording studio by myself, because I use it for film score work or for bands I'm producing or other things I'm doing. If we were to run this strictly as a standalone business, and that was the design, I would have thought about it in a different way.
Yeah.
And it probably wouldn't have come out as great.
Well, I have to say, it's one of my favorite places. I always enjoy going there and hanging there. Of course, I enjoy hanging with you, but to hang with you in your studio is always a real joy. It's a real treat. So one day I'll work there.
Thank you.
Be even better.
Well, anytime you want to, Bobby. And I've always felt like at this point, my studio speaks better of me than I do in a way, you know?
Yeah.
It's been a great calling card for me. It's helped me out quite, I can give examples of where it has actually made me look good at the right time and led to work for me as a composer or as a producer. It's helped me in that way.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I can give an example of it. I was looking to get I'm not going to put names to it, not because I'm saying anything disparaging, but I just don't think it's appropriate. There was a movie that I was interested in scoring that a music supervisor had told me about, said, "Hey, Richard, you should get this job." And I didn't know the director. And this music supervisor said, "Well, here's what you do. He's doing a little independent movie now that has very low money, but I happen to know he needs a composer for that now, and then he's going to need a composer for this big studio picture later. That's his next thing on his agenda. Why don't you go offer to help him with that?" So I did exactly that. I went and saw the little indie movie. I was the right guy to do it, and I was what would have been normally out of his market range, you know, to score it. But I was happy to do it. I liked the director immediately. We hit it off, watched the movie. I said, "Sure, I'll do it for you." And it was for a fraction of my normal fee. So I'd be happy to do it. But I was, I had him come out to meet with me out at the studio because I wanted him to see the studio. And the studio was still relatively new then. And, you know, we went out to lunch afterward and talked about the whole project. And he said, "Well, you're interested in my little movie?" I said, "Sure, I'd love to do it, but I'm going to be honest with you. What I'm after is your next project, and all I ask is that if we have a good experience on this little one, that you put me on the front of the list for the big one. That's all I ask. I'm not asking you to commit right now to hiring me to that. That's too much to ask. But if we hit it off, and I think we will, I'd love for you, you know, I'd love to work on that one too, because that's what enables me to do the little movies. The big movies subsidizes the little ones, right?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, I get it. That makes perfect sense. You're on." So I said, "Great." So I didn't hear from him for a few weeks. And I knew that what their schedule was. I thought, God, I should have been working on this already. So I called him up and said, "Hey, what's going on? Shouldn't we be getting started? Is your schedule pushed?" He goes, "Oh, no. He said, "I hired somebody else." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, I hired somebody else to do that." He said, "I saw your studio. There's no way I want you working on that little movie. I want you working on the big one." So he ended up hiring, coincidentally, a friend of mine to score the smaller movie, and he hired me to do the big movie because of the studio. He saw what the level of work that I did was, you know, how I thought and what my standards were. And you think, no, I just went in working on that. I don't want to even thinking about this little indie movie right now. So there's a very concrete example of exactly what that studio has done for me. I can give more stories like that.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
It turned out to be a good investment in that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's kind of like I've met some people that are in the industry living in Malibu. There's a lot of us around here. And if, you know, one day I met this guy at the market. I just ran into this guy at the market. And he goes, "You're Richard, right?" I didn't know him. I didn't know who he was. And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah, your son Keegan is good friends with my son." And I said, "Oh, right." And I knew who his son was. And I said, "Oh, nice to meet you." And he said, "You're a great guy." And I go, "You just met me in the market." You know, I'm looking at him. And he goes, "No, the reason I said that is your son is amazing. So I know you must be a great guy." So that's kind of like this in a way. You know, it's like, well, that's my son. All three of our kids speak very well for me.
Yeah, they do.
Of course, my wife deserves more than half the credit of that, but but nevertheless, I'm the beneficiary of it. And that's the same with the studio. It's the same kind of thing. It speaks well for me. I couldn't be happier about that outcome.
For more info on Woodshed Recording, go to Woodshed Recording, all one word, Woodshed, S-H-E-D, recording.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.